Hello there. Servus. My name is Tyshawn Wade, and you're listening to This Week in Geopolitics, where we take a look at the events of yesterday and detail how they paint the geopolitical reality of today. And today we've got some stories. We have the rising dynamism of the East. We have Blinken's journey to the Middle East. And then we're going to talk about Poland doubling the size of its military and what that might mean moving forward. All that and more coming up. Alrighty, let's get into the rapid-fire news of today's episode, and we'll start with a story that we covered last time, the helicopter crash in Kiev, where the interior minister died. An update to that is that apparently among the 16 people who died, which included the interior minister himself, apparently they were all a part of his team, like his entire team that he has around him to help him implement his policy. So further fanning the flames of that internal power struggle that we sort of covered last time on the podcast. Now, where exactly that puts the country, I can't really tell you. I can't tell you what faction he was or wasn't on. I can just tell you that for now, the speculation is that the helicopter crash was a legitimate accident because there was bad weather. But you know me, I love me some speculation. And the other speculation is that it was a deliberate attack on the helicopter to bring it down along with him and his entire team. Now, I have given the benefit of the doubt to the Ukrainians on this whole issue, and then I had to fess up to that when I ended up being wrong. So I'm just gonna leave all that on the table. And we'll see what becomes of that from this point moving forward. There was also those missiles that hit an apartment building in Dnipro, which was blamed on Russia, because of course it was. And it ended up being, yet again, a Ukrainian air defense missile that flew way off course and hit Ukrainian infrastructure. And it was blamed on the Russians, because the Russians are bombing Ukrainian infrastructure anyway. But the Russians don't bomb civilian targets, housing, schools, etc., unless the Ukrainian military is hiding in them, like they did with that mall way, way back in the early days of the war, when they hit this mall with a thermal barrack and wiped out a whole slew of Ukrainian troops that were using the mall as a base of operations. So it's highly likely that this trend will continue, where the Ukrainians will hit themselves with their own missiles and blame the Russians for it, and the propaganda press will cover the water for them, or cover, more like carry. And that's how this is going to go down. We're just in a world of lies. That's where we are. We have the United States designating the Wagner Group as a terror. Actually, we've only designated them as a criminal organization. That's new. I'm sure that they'll be upgraded to terrorist organization at some point. And Wagner is the private military group, essentially mercenaries that fight on the Russian side, and they've been playing an integral role in the battles around Bakhmut. They played a key role in taking of Soledar, and they were really proud of that one. They did a whole interview detailing how exactly they did it. Now, Zelensky still hasn't accepted that Soledar has fallen, mind you, so that's still a concern. But Wagner is being put increasingly under the spotlight as the battle for Bakhmut intensifies and grows in its importance because of the numbers involved. And I've actually, courtesy of the Duran, managed to get my hands on a solid number. Well, at least a workable one. They themselves don't have a solid number, but they give 30,000 to 100,000 on the Ukrainian side alone, Now, Durant went with the 30,000 number. I think the 30,000 number is appropriate as well, because you have a critical mass there. When you look at the kinds of losses that the Ukrainians are taking, you can't take those kinds of losses and still have troops in a defensible position without having a sizable force there. I mean, if you remember back when the Kherson offensive happened, they lost literally thousands of men in a week. Now, little did I know just how bad the losses were. I personally found that out later in December, and I shared it with you. The net negative of 17,000 combat troops. Yeah, so factoring that in, just looking at the kinds of losses you saw with the Kherson offensive, you can't take 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 losses in the space of a few weeks and still have a defensive position unless you have 10,000 plus there to reinforce, because you can't reinforce a position that doesn't have troops there. They have to be there. Otherwise, you're just moving new troops in to cover a hole. So I think that 30,000 figure would be appropriate for the number of Ukrainian defenders here, and appropriate for the battle space as a whole, not just Bakhmut itself, but the space. That gives you plenty of room to maneuver in terms of the numbers for there to be multiple battles in multiple smaller towns and villages around Bakhmut. And it makes sense because you, again, have that critical mass of men to where you can take 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 losses and still have a force there that can do things that's operational. So I think that 30,000 plus figure is appropriate. And I also think 30,000 itself is an appropriate number given the size of the Ukrainian army and how fast it's shrinking. We brought up how it's essentially, well, they're getting to the point where they're almost the same size as what the Russians had going in, which means they're going to have issues manning the front line. And for those who haven't gotten quite my numbers on that, back when Zaluzhny gave that interview to The Economist, he said they had 190,000 troops. They started the war, mind you, with 350,000. So to go from 350,000 to 190,000, that's a loss of 160,000 troops. 160,000. And the war started in the end of February, but we got these numbers in like early December. December wasn't over yet. I said it was 160,000 in 10 months. It wasn't really 10 months because 10 months would have been December 24th. But we got those numbers in the early to mid December. So throw on another 10,000. Now you have 170,000 losses spread out over actually 10 months, which brings the number up from 16,000 a month to 17,000 a month. I also ran that same figure backwards, you know, the 160,000, and then divided it by 9 instead of, you know, throwing on an extra 10,000. And the number actually, when you do that, it comes up to 18,000 a month. So given that I lowballed the losses the first time, because before we got those numbers, I was operating under the impression that the Ukrainians had lost anywhere from 40 to 50,000 tops in terms of troops. So I'll just throw that 18,000 a month figure out there in the likely event that I'm still underestimating the rates of loss here. And heck, even that might be an underestimation in and of itself. But I'll leave that with you to do with as you please. Maybe you think that that's a more appropriate figure given the numbers that we're starting to get access to as this war goes on. But I'm going to run with that 17,000 figure because it still leaves us with some room to work with if the losses do end up being smaller, at least for a few months or a few weeks. But now that we're here at the end of January, we can add, well, more accurately, we can subtract another 17,000 from the troops that they had. And again, I got that 17,000 from adding 10,000 onto the 160,000. And that would account for the losses the rest of December. Then you can divide that by 10 to get the monthly figure. But if you add 10,000 losses, that means you're taking away 10,000 from the 190,000 that Ukraine had left. So Now we're subtracting 17,000 from the 180,000 remainder. Ukraine is somewhere in the vicinity of 163,000 troops right now. If that rate of loss holds up for, you know, these last few weeks. And that essentially puts them where I thought that they were going to be in February, because I did not factor in that adding on 10,000 extra losses, I would have to take away 10,000 from the number of troops that they still had left. So, factoring in all those things together, they're down, again, assuming that these rates of losses hold up, which we don't have much reason not to believe, they're down to 163,000 men, just about, which is almost dead even to what the Russians had going in. And they're going to be even lower, they're going to be well below that upon the anniversary of the war. I mean, 163,000 now, you take away another 17,000, you're talking 146,000 troops? And Russia had issues manning the front line right up until they finally got some of those troops from their first mobilization onto the front? Like, their front line is going to fall apart. It's going to be Swiss cheese. And once it's Swiss cheese, it's worse for the Ukrainians because they're on the defensive and the Russians are just going to start walking around their lines. But back to Bakhmut, and I bring up those numbers to give you an idea of what we're dealing with here. Bakhmut with 30,000, that 30,000 figure that I'm happy to have to work with for the Ukrainians and for the battle as a whole, because we can now model off of that for our speculations. Because the Russians are attacking, and they have increasingly numerical superiority. So if they're attacking and they're winning, and usually you need more men on the offense than you need on the defense, if you're going to beat the defensive position, we can assume, and here we go right into the speculation, we can assume that Russia has around 40 to 45,000 troops engaged in the Battle of Bakhmut and all the surrounding towns. You put those together, and that's 60 to 75,000 men, and that itself may still end up being a low ball, because remember, we're working with the lower end figures here. The Duran was looking at numbers of 30 to 100,000, so it could be the number of Ukrainian troops in Donbass and in Bakhmut could be well around 50,000, as far as we know. And then the Russian numbers would have to be equal to or higher than that. And now you're talking straight up 100,000 plus men here, but just going off these lower end estimates, you're talking easily 70,000 plus. And I'm assuming that the Russians have 45,000 to the Ukrainian 30,000. That's 75,000. And when you run the numbers on that, you see that the Ukrainians are down to 160,000 roughly. And the Russians are probably up to 170,000, 180,000, maybe 190,000 in terms of combat troops, because they're bringing in those men from their reserves that they mobilized all those months ago. You put it together, you have, well, just about the same number of men as the Ukrainians had going into the war. In total, on both sides, because of Ukrainian attrition, and the Russians now building up their force strength. And so if we go with 160,000 Ukrainians and 180,000 Russians, and we're not counting the Russian military as a whole, because their military is huge and growing by the second. But if we're just going off the troops in Ukraine, that's 343,000 men. 75,000 in Donbass alone, that is 20% of the total number of men engaged in the war. And no one's talking about it. Like, if you don't go to Scott Ritter, if you don't go to Douglas McGregor, if you don't go to the Duran or the Gray Zone, you won't even hear the word Bakhmut. So it's insane. When I finally got my hands on these numbers and put them into perspective, It's crazy that it's not being talked about. It's crazy. Like, that'd be like not talking about Stalingrad during World War II. That'd be like not talking about the that'd be like during the Napoleonic Wars, not talking about the Battle of Borodino, or not talking about the Battle of Leipzig. That'd be like not talking about El Alamein, or Guadalcanal, or Midway, or Kursk, or the Battle of Britain. How do you not talk about this? Like, again, if you don't go to Douglas MacGregor, the Duran, or Scott Ritter, or the Grayson, you won't even hear the word Bakhmut. You'll be hard-pressed to find the word Bakhmut written, let alone any detailed talk on what's going on there. And you have this many troops, 20% of the total number of men engaged in the war as a whole are engaged in Donbass, not Donbass, in Bakhmut alone. This is the last gambit. This is the decisive battle of the war, folks. Like, and I, it's much better saying that now when we have some numbers to work with instead of me just shooting in the dark, as I've been for the past. I hope I've done a decent job of doing that, but goodness, it's insane. And this is where our press is. This is the absolute state of the modern press. I mean, I know I call them the propaganda press, but goddamn, nothing, not a word, not a peep. It's true insanity. Now that I have some context behind how big the battle is. But that's where we are. And it's only going to get worse for Ukraine. Like, again, when the anniversary of this war comes around, they're going to be coming up on that 140,000 troop number. They're going to be below the 160,000. And this entire war, Russia had issues manning the front line with those 160,000 troops that they had. Potentially more. I've been running with that low number. The range was 160,000 to 200,000. So if my going off the lower end number was wrong and they actually were struggling to keep the line together with the full 200,000, which was the higher end estimate at the time, then Ukraine is already in trouble. In deep, deep, deep trouble. Now that they're down to 160,000 just about. What happens in March? What happens in May, in April, when they start coming up to and then dipping below the 100,000 number? Because this is a net negative of 17,000. Whatever the rate that they're able to bring their reserves online into combat-ready status, they are still, whatever that is, you can subtract that, and then another 17,000 men. It's a net negative of 17,000. Which, quite frankly, implies that the number of wounded and the actual casualties are even higher than the 177,000 figure, once we add in the extra 17,000, the actual casualties may actually be way higher than that. I'm just going off the loss of combat-capable troops that we can observe. So who knows what the actual casualty figure is for Ukraine? And we'll find out eventually, but my God. And I just wanted to throw that in there. This is huge. And we talked about catastrophic defeat. In Bakhmut, Ukraine doesn't need it. But if Zelensky can't get a grip with reality and pull his troops out, and Bakhmut does end up encircled, now that we have some numbers to go off of, that's a ridiculous number of men to just lose overnight. Because you didn't want to pull out. 30,000 is crazy. Like, I was down there dabbling with 5,000, 10,000, oh, maybe 11 or 12,000. 30,000 is crazy. That's the end of the war. If this city gets encircled, and even half of these troops get encircled, as Bakhmut looks like it's getting closer and closer to being encircled, and there's not a withdrawal in sight. If even half of these men get encircled, that's an entire month's worth of casualties in an instant, cut off, and they're not going to get them back. Like, my God. This is it. This is it, folks. This is the deciding battle of the war. And from this point on, I don't see anything other than collapse of the front line. Like, it was gonna happen sometime in the spring. But with these kinds of developments, and again, I'm assuming only half of the people in Bakhmut get encircled. If they don't pull out, they still can, but they don't want to. Imagine if that full 30,000 number gets encircled. Imagine if I'm lowballing the number still, and the actual number is closer to 40 or 50,000. And imagine they get encircled. What? There's no more war left to fight after that. The number of men involved in this battle are so huge, and the Ukrainian forces are dwindling so fast, that sort of a catastrophic defeat in Bakhmut would actually legitimately be catastrophic. It wouldn't be metaphorical at that point. It would actually be catastrophic. And there'd just be nothing left. There's no way they can man that front line if they lose all these troops in Bakhmut. There's just no way. And the Russians will just sit there and pound away at them with artillery until they starve, and then they surrender. And then they'll take the city. And Ukraine and everybody in the West who thought that Ukraine was going to win will be looking crazy, absolutely crazy, when the realization just smacks us all in the face. And by us, I mean them, because, you know, we here at this podcast, we know what's going on. But the normies, the I stand with Ukraine types, they're going to wake up one day. If things continue on this trend, they're going to wake up one day and realize that Ukraine lost the war. And then they'll have to watch as Ukraine loses the war, as they proceed to die as a country, as a nation, probably to never emerge again. We're gonna see another wave of, I expect another wave of exiles and refugees, which will only clear the ground for Russian resettlement of the entire country. There'll still be about 20,000 out of 15 to 20,000 out of the Ukrainian population, the pre-war population. And they'll be perfectly fine with Russian rule. So there's no partisan war, there's no heartburn from annexing all this territory. It'll be empty. And the Russians will just resettle it. The Greater Russian Federation will be born. And that's what we're looking at in Bakhmut. But let me get back to the rapid fire. I've gone on this massive tangent. We have the U.S. set to send 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, which has prompted Germany to give in to the peer pressure. Now they're sending their Leopard 2 tanks. And then, of course, that wasn't enough, because now the conversation has shifted towards sending fighter jets to Ukraine and long-range missiles to Ukraine. But who's going to man these weapons systems? Because the Ukrainians can't. They don't have the time to learn. At these rates of losses, they'll all be dead by the time they get through the training program. So that opens the door for speculation on Western contractors. Yeah, contractors going in and manning the weapons themselves, which really just means direct involvement in the war, if we're all being perfectly honest with ourselves. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on in the episode. But we will see that that's where the conversation is shifted, because it's never enough. It's never enough. We have M23, the rebel group in Ukraine, in Congo, getting aggressive again. We have fighting between Israel and Palestine bubbling up again. We have Russia expelling Maris Rekstins. I thought that was Stein, but it's just Stins. Russia has expelled Maris Rekstins, the Latvian ambassador to Russia. And we'll dive into that a little bit more later on in the episode. We have Pakistan making plans for Gwadar, a city in their southwest, right on the border with Iran. It's a coastal city. They have plans for that to become a major business hub with the backing of Iranian power grid connections and China's Belt and Road. And last but not least, we have Japan and their ambassador to India seeking closer relations between Japan and India this year, especially as India and Japan will head and host the G20 and G7, respectively. And we will see what comes of this, I imagine. With these two countries in charge specifically, these meetings will have a strong emphasis on the multipolar world rather than the liberal Western unipolar world. And we'll see how the liberal West responds to that. But that's another story, and we'll get into the meat of this episode in just a moment. And we're back to talk about the first story of the episode, the rising dynamism of the East. Now, we've talked a bit about the emerging multipolar world order. In fact, it was the main subject of my second anniversary episode, along with what America's place in that world should be. Spoiler alert, isolationist America for the win. But since then, when I published that anniversary episode, the topic of the multipolar world has only gained in its relevancy. Way more than I could have anticipated. And the Russo-Ukrainian War has served a really good purpose in showing us where the dividing line is. Because it has given us a very clear picture of who's on board with the multipolar world and who's against it. And it almost broke down how you would have expected, but certainly some countries were expected to be in different places than they were before, well, than they are now, with Turkey being one of them. And I can essentially break down that, I can break that down by saying that America, Europe, and the Anglosphere are against it, whereas Russia, Asia, and the Middle East are gung-ho for it, while the rest of the world is remaining neutral to positive towards it. They're open to it, all right? Africa, Latin America, they are fully open to the multipolar world, and it means less interference in their internal affairs by a certain United States of America, so they're open to it. And of course, there's exceptions to that general breakdown of the West versus East, and then there's the rest of the world. There's exceptions to that. I mean, just look at Hungary, Serbia, and Greece. They are all increasingly open towards cheap Russian energy infrastructure, as well as China's Belt and Road, which are sort of the hallmarks of this multipolar world, especially with the dividing lines of the Russo-Ukrainian War. Because before, it didn't mean all that much. It was really just the Belt and Road. If you're on board the Belt and Road, you're on board China. But with the Russo-Ukrainian War now, if you're on board Russian energy, you're not just against America and the West. You're not just pro-China. You're not even just pro-Russia. You're not even just a Russian asset. You are pro-multipolar world. And therefore, you are against the American Empire. Like, that's what the war has essentially done. It's turned these things that didn't mean this before into things that mean it now. Like, countries, all of Europe was dependent on Russian natural gas before. But it's only with this war now that being supplied by Russian natural gas is just this dividing line. And so, it's served a really good purpose of showing us who is and isn't on board. And Hungary, Serbia, and Greece are sort of the exemptions to the West, who is by and large against the multipolar world, but Hungary's open to relations with Russia, Serbia has always been friends with Russia, Greece is on board the Belt and Road. They haven't quite figured out what their relationship is going to be with Russia yet, but they're on board the Belt and Road. So even in different ways, you see that general breakdown doesn't hold up completely. And the same goes true the other way around. I mean, you have, where am I? You have Turkey. Turkey, who we thought would be all in on opposing Russia, opposing China, they are open towards cheap Russian energy infrastructure and increasingly open towards China's Belt and Road. I mean, heck, they are hell-bent on becoming a gas hub for Russian energy. And then there's Japan, who hasn't quite decided what direction they will go in. And they are the East, the quintessential Eastern nation. They're as far east as you can go, unless you want to stick around in Russia. But they haven't decided. They've actually been very quiet over the course of this entire war. So that general breakdown doesn't hold true with Japan. Now, up till now, the momentum of Japan's alliance with us has been driving them towards conflict with China, primarily over Taiwan, and towards a rejection of the multipolar world. That's the momentum of their alliance with us. But again, when you see how quiet they've been regarding all of the events really surrounding the Ukraine war, the ultimate purity test for whether you're on board or against the multipolar world, you see that that momentum is starting to slow, and Japan increasingly speaking about peace, like they're doing with India, increasingly speaking about working with their neighbors rather than against them. That's subtle for, we don't want to fight a war with China, we don't want to get involved in a war in Europe. They probably mean that as well when they say that they want peace, but the subtle suggestion that they don't want to be involved in these other things is probably also true as well. But if they're not on board war with China, if they're not pro-Ukraine, then that can only mean that they are on board the multipolar world. At least that's how it will be perceived, but the truth is Japan just haven't decided yet. So they're a very interesting case because they haven't decided. Then you also have Burma. But Burma's, again, another special case because they're in a bit of a rough spot, especially after the military stepped in and took over the country again. We'll see where they go when all is said and done. Afghanistan is another one. They haven't quite decided what they want to do. They're still busy tidying up at home, and we'll get their answer in time. I believe that they will be eager to grab onto the Belt and Road when they can, but only time will tell. So that east-west breakdown does have its exceptions on both sides. But the geographical breakdown of the pro and anti factions of the multipolar world, like I've suggested, do give us a sort of east versus west dynamic, which has sort of been thought about for a while now when you think Russia and China versus America and NATO, EU, as that's the World War III framing. So we have a de facto version of that, although it's not quite exactly that way. It's not really an east versus west. It's really just Russia, China, and a handful of Middle Eastern states who are genuinely belligerent towards the West, and not without good reason. But that geographical breakdown, you can also see, is more concentrated the way the results that both sides are getting. Like, the geographical breakdown, you can see the results of being pro or against the multipolar world, because of that geographic concentration. The West, geographically concentrated in the western parts of the world, like literally to the west of the Middle East, you can see what that's getting us. And then to the east of the Middle East, you can see what being pro-multipolar world is getting you. So that geographic breakdown also helps to see and visualize not just the factions, but the results of those factions. And I gotta say, the East, they're looking magnificent. They're looking very, very magnificent. The East having embraced the multipolar world, having embraced cheap Russian energy, and embraced Chinese infrastructure projects, they are seeing massive growth in their economies, rising standards of living, rising affordability of essential goods, and longer lifespans, and a general industrialization across the board. The West, on the other hand, having rejected the multipolar world, rejected cheap Russian energy, rejected Chinese infrastructure projects, we are stagnating in a way that has become more and more visible when compared to the vibrancy of the other side. The East is set to host most of the top 10 largest economies in the world by the end of the century, with America and Brazil essentially being some of the only non-Eastern countries to make the list. And America's projected to be number 3 at that point, if not number 4. So the East is growing rapidly to the point where they're going to dominate the top 10 list. I mean, and if America's number 3, that means someone else has to be either number 2 or number 1, and that someone else is looking like it's going to be India, with China being either number 1 or number 2 as well. The East is cutting deals. They're turning crises into opportunity for themselves. Case in point, India being able to profit off the sale of a resource that they don't have, I will never let it go. I am still impressed. And it makes me all the more disappointed in my own country because we have the oil and we still can't get it right. It's a damn shame. But they did that. And it's not even just India. You have Turkey becoming the indispensable nation to both Russia and the West. Using the, like, putting themselves into the thick of it to gain this ridiculous amount of leverage. Finland and Sweden want to join NATO. You can't just join the alliance without my say-so. You're going to give me those Kurds in your country. You're going to stop giving money to those Kurds, aren't you? Aren't you friends? Aren't you pal? You're going to stop doing that, right? And guess what? They have to stop doing it if they want to be a part of NATO. They have to stop doing it, which means that Turkey extorted NATO for concessions. And we'll see if that sets a precedent. I think it will. Turkey nationalized the Straits. And no one batted an eye. Whoa, Russia, you want to... We have some reports that you're stealing Ukrainian grain. We're gonna have to board that ship and make sure it's really yours. So you're going to have to dock in Turkey for us to check it before we allow you to go through the Straits. By treaty, they're not allowed to do that. By international treaty, Turkey's not allowed to do that. But they were given a free pass to do so by literally everyone. No one questioned this. No one questioned the legality of this. Nobody questioned it, not even the Russians. And that's the crazy part. They nationalized the Straits, and no one noticed. No one except for yours truly, of course. Like, this is what the East is up to. They are turning crisis into opportunity. And those are just some of the really good cases. I mean, China's been on lockdown throughout the whole war. Like, they're only just now reawakening their industrial engine. And we'll see where that gets them. They're looking at double-digit growth again. Just as a matter of getting back on track. And we'll see where that gets them. I imagine it's going to humiliate everyone else in the West who deliberately sabotage their own economies. Like, this is what the East is going to get you. It's going to get you cheap goods, cheap food, cheap energy, cheap infrastructure, and economic growth. That's what the East is promising you. And then you have the West. The East is doing all this. Meanwhile, the West, we sanction ourselves into poverty and insolvency over someone else's war. The West is witnessing stagnating economies on the verge of depression, every single one of them, without fail. Falling standards of living. rising costs of essential goods, and a deliberate attempt at deindustrialization, the green agenda. And, if you can believe it, an average lifespan that has actually started to shrink since 2020. America specifically saw like a 1.5 year reduction in our average lifespans, while China, even through its lockdowns, which only just ended, they've had an increase. They are now at 77 years on average, while we are at 76. And that's where we are. The Middle East is growing, but their growth has been stunted by all the wars going on, and the destruction caused by those wars. However, the destruction caused by those wars will incentivize them to then turn to Russia and China to help rebuild. And as the wars in Syria and Yemen and Libya come to a close, you will see the Middle East recover and then start booming. Like, it's going to be, it won't just be the China miracle, it won't just be the Japan miracle or the German miracle. It'll be the Eastern miracle. It's going to be just about every damn body. Courtesy of the Belt and Road and courtesy of Russian infrastructure. Not infrastructure. Energy infrastructure. With the Belt and Road running from east to west and Russian energy running from north to south, it just makes everything livable. In a place that we didn't think that would be possible. But that's because we ourselves could not have ever provided that for them. It had to be Russia and it had to be China. We don't live over there. It's just not something that we could do. We could attempt. It would have been expensive. We probably could have done it. But it's just not something that would have been very much a thing for us to do or have a reason to do. Russia and China, on the other hand, they have plenty of reason, which is why they're doing it now. It had to be them. And that's okay. We don't need to be over there. And Europe, quite frankly, is going to have issues finding its place in the world. America has a default place in the world, which is not to be in the world at all. That's our default position, and Americans will be perfectly fine with that. A return to what is, for us, normal. It's Europe who's going to have to find their way again when America goes home. And we will have to when the economic collapse comes. When the dollar is no longer the reserve currency of the world, and that's coming as well. When we can't just print money to solve all of our problems, suddenly America's going to have really big issues maintaining all these military bases overseas, maintaining our military presence in all these different countries, and maintaining the empire in general. When the economy has collapsed and the currency has collapsed and our ability to service the debt falls apart, we're going to have to go home. Economic necessity will force us to go home, and anyone who says anything else will be politically exiled at that point in time. Certainly intervention in someone else's war, that just won't even, that'll be a non-starter. So at some point in the not-too-distant future, America will be forced to go home. I would have preferred if we left on our own accords. But we're going to be forced to go home anyway. And when that happens, America will default to isolationism. And Europe will be left high and dry. They'll have to figure out where they're going to go. I can't tell you where they're going to go. The direction is going to be different for a lot of them. Britain, if they're smart, they will take advantage of Brexit and start negotiating trade deals now. They're unfortunately not smart, and they don't have the leadership for that. I don't mean that as an insult. I mean they literally don't have leadership right now. Like, they've gone through eight... okay, I'm exaggerating. They've gone through three prime ministers in the blink of an eye. Sunak is eventually going to be on his way out as well. That'll be number three. Boris is sticking around, but his relevancy is dying by the second. And no one even remembers Liz Truss. And quite frankly, I think she's happy with it being that way. Britain doesn't have the leadership they need to take advantage of Brexit. This massive edge that they have over literally everyone else in Europe is that they are not in the EU. They are not constrained by EU law. They are not constrained by EU trade regulation. They can operate freely. And yet they fumbled the bag anyway. So now they're gonna tumble. Now maybe they'll get a grip, and they're gonna start getting those trade deals up and running. They're gonna start fostering the growth of domestic industry. We'll see. France is probably gonna try to carve out their place in Europe again. I don't know if it's gonna work out that way. I don't know if it will. I doubt that it will. So long as Germany exists, and France is gonna be forced to look elsewhere as well. And the Portuguese and the Spanish already are, just in a very, very subtle way. But as the West, this idea of a unified West collapses and all the Western nations have to start looking out for themselves and going their own ways again, Portugal and Spain, they'll be partners in crime as they head out around the world to negotiate business. Because it's not, they're not going to get anything from Europe. They might get a deal with France. But why would they want to be a part of what Europe has to offer when Europe is in recession? They're not going to want that. Italy, same thing. Except they're going to be much more constrained because they're in the middle of the Mediterranean. They don't have access to the Atlantic. So for them, it'll be a balance between Europe and Africa. And with a little bit of the Middle East tipped in there as well. They're going to be a central hub of pipe. Italy's going to be a gas hub as well for gas coming in to southern Europe. Namely from the Middle East, from the Eastern Mediterranean, and from North Africa. Italy's going to be a gas hub as well. Just like Turkey, just like Spain and Portugal. So the major states in the southern Europe, what's going to be good for them isn't going to be the same as what's going to be good for the Western European states. And what's good for the West European states is going to be different from the North. What will Germany do? I don't know. What will Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, what will they do? I don't know. What's Poland going to do? Oh my goodness, I don't know. They're going to have to find their way. And they're going to have to do it without the United States. America will find its way. It doesn't take much for us to find our way, because our way is right here in the United States, where we belong. And that'll be a fun world to look at and speculate on. But that's what we're dealing with. As the East and the West come to a heads, and the West has their economic collapse, which they'll eventually recover from. We'll eventually recover from the recession. Well, I say recession, I should really be saying depression, but I will play along, recession. America will be fine. Europe, I'm not sure if there's going to be an EU on the other side of that. I certainly pray to God there's no NATO, and I think the Russians will handle that for me. But that's what we're looking at. And then, in the midst of the depths of an economic depression, you'll have the East as a shining light. They will be the city on the hill, the shining city on the hill, at least until America can get its shit back together. And hopefully when we do get our shit back together, we don't have idiots saying things like, we need to pivot to Asia. No. What we need to do is stay right here at home and negotiate these trade deals. That's what we need to do. But I'll digress. But the war in Ukraine has given us a really good picture of where countries around the world stand on the issue of the multipolar world. And the countries that stand against it are currently the ones standing to lose. And since we're speaking about people standing to lose, why don't we jump right into Anthony Blinken and his journey to the Middle East, which is a small-scale case against U.S. leadership, in my opinion. Now, I won't be too mean to Blinken. He's not the personification of the argument against American leadership. No, the personification of the case against American leadership would be the fraud-in-chief and his vice-failure, Biden and Kamala. Has anyone seen Kamala? I haven't seen her. You know what? We're better off with that. We're better off not seeing her. Oh, that's right. The last time I saw her was when Zelensky came to town. And then we never saw her again. What a not shame. So anyway, we have the U.S. Secretary of Embarrassment, Secretary of State, with the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, visiting Egypt as he begins his tour of the Middle East, which isn't really a tour of the Middle East. I don't even know why they bothered calling it that. It's really just a visit to Egypt and Israel. And that's what it is. Because the reason I'm emphasizing that so much is because I spent like a good 15 minutes looking to see the list of other countries he was going to go to. It's like, well, if he's taking a trip to the Middle East, if he's taking a tour of the Middle East, you know, where's the Middle Eastern countries? Is he going to go to Saudi Arabia? Is he going to go to Iran? Well, I know for a fact he's not going to go to Iran. Is he going to go to the UAE? Is he going to go to Turkey? Like, where's he going to go? Oh, turns out he's only going to Egypt and Israel and Palestine. And I'm like, okay. But he went to Egypt. He spoke some nice, wonderful nothings. And while he was there, no one was really talking about his trip to Egypt. And again, it's not like he was going to accomplish anything real there anyway. But the big fuss was about him going to Israel during the recent round of fighting between Israel and Palestine. And there was talk about how he was going to have such a great struggle trying to find a diplomatic breakthrough on the issue. And now look, I am someone who holds Blinken I do not hold him in high regards. I don't even hold him in low regards. I hold him in negative regards. I expect of him failure, embarrassment, and disappointment. That being said, I don't know what people could reasonably expect Blinken to do about the Israel-Palestine issue. The Israelis and the Palestinians have yet to solve that issue. Even once. They have yet to solve it once. Like, even on a temporary basis. They just can't do it. No president, no secretary of state before him. No one has gotten a grip on this issue. I don't expect Blinken to be that guy. He's not that guy. Trust me, he's not that guy. So I don't know what these news outlets were expecting of him. That were really just hyping him up, like he was gonna have this massive challenge on his hands. And it is a massive challenge, but to say that it's on his hands is stretching it a bit. that's about as nice to Blinken as I'm gonna get. But to me, the Israel-Palestine issue is one of those let them deal with it kind of issues, you know? And I say that, one, because their conflict is, quite frankly, not my problem, or Blinken's problem, to be honest with you, and I'm pretty sure he would concur on that. And two, I say that because you have two parties contesting the same plot of land. That historically doesn't go very well, and historically doesn't get negotiated, it gets resolved. Which means that them disputing this land means that there can't be any sort of lasting peace between the both sides. Oh, I say the both. Between both sides. Until both sides come to the conclusion that such a peace is in their interests. And neither Israel nor Palestine have come to that conclusion yet. Maybe they will at some point in the future. Maybe they won't. We'll see. But for the time being, the fighting is just going to continue regardless of what Blinken says or does. So, which is why, even with how negative of an opinion I have about him, I don't think it's fair to him to try to put all this on him all of a sudden, as though he was the one responsible. He's not, and I ain't either. But, you know, on this issue, nothing he does needs to be of meaning here. Like, the United States, in general, does not need to involve itself in the affairs of faraway countries. Just because we have before doesn't mean it was a good idea, and certainly doesn't make it right. Like, we definitely don't need to be getting involved in other people's wars. Especially a war as nasty as the one being fought between those two. I mean, you have the Palestinian fighters burrowing, and I say burrowing metaphorically, but digging in and entrenching themselves in civilian infrastructure, in hospitals, in schools, and in apartment blocks, so that when the Israelis fire on them, the Israelis are firing on civilians by default. And it's just nasty. But if the Israelis don't do that, if they don't fire on that little Palestinian kid, the little Palestinian kid is going to pull out a Glock and start... Okay, I'm exaggerating just a little bit, but the Palestinians are not above child soldiers. And when I say Palestinians and when I say Israel, I mean the people fighting the war, right? I don't mean literally everyone in these countries is just bloodthirsty and out to kill the other. But the people fighting are bloodthirsty and killers. Like, that's what they're trained and armed to do. They are soldiers. They are fighters. And this war is nasty. There are child soldiers. There are underage minors being used as fighters in this war. So you can either shoot little Timmy, or you can take the risk that little Timmy won't shoot you or your partner or your company. Now, which one are you going to take? Because as far as you're concerned, you killed little Timmy's dad. Little Timmy might have an issue with that. You going to let him get to you, or you going to get him first? It's nasty. And that's as close to a defense of Israel as you're going to get out of me. look at me being so reasonable and so nice to all these places and countries and people, Blinken, that I don't care for. I'm sorry. Yeah. But seriously, it's a let them deal with it kind of issue. Like, Israel and Palestine are going to have to work this out. And they're the only ones who can. I am not going to be the one to solve this problem for them. We haven't solved it for them in the last, 50, 60, 70 years? We're not going to solve it now. Like, there hasn't been any change in the environment, the political environment. No opening has happened to where we can go, oh yes, this is our chance. We can finally solve it. No, that hasn't happened. Will it happen eventually? Maybe, but it hasn't happened. So to expect that we're going to change this now, to expect that Blinken, of all people, is going to be the one to do anything meaningful on this now, is just absurd and not fair to old Blinken. And that's what I'll say. So the fighting will continue. The war is dirty. And we don't need to be getting involved in that. We really don't. I mean, just look at how well getting involved and doing something is working out for us right now. Look at how it's working out for us in Ukraine. Look how it's working out for us in Iraq and in Syria. Or do I even need to bring up Afghanistan? I won't, even though I already have. But you know, you get the point I'm making. We'd be better off minding our own business. We have plenty to do here at home anyway. Homelessness is on the rise, crime is on the rise, and our border doesn't exist. So instead of visiting random-ass countries like Egypt, instead of sticking our noses in Israel's internal problems, which have been there since the dawn of Israel in the 1940s, Blinken should have been taking trips to Mexico, Guatemala, and Panama. If we got an agreement with them, for them to enforce their own border controls, that would have the effect of preventing migrant caravans from even making it to within 1,000 miles of our border. That would cause sharp reductions in the human trafficking, the drug trafficking, and sex trafficking going on across the southern border. It is mutually beneficial between us and those countries because we'd essentially just be asking them, and Central America as a whole, to uphold their own sovereignty, which is something that they would be in favor of doing. And plus, they don't like the migrants moving through their countries anyway. They don't like having masses of people that they don't know walking through their country as though they own the place. They don't appreciate the migrants, and it's to a shocking degree. You know, people in America would be called racist for suggesting that we shouldn't be letting in all these people. My gosh, Central America can't stand these people. Mexico being a chief offender of that, so if you will. So they already have the anti-migrant sentiment in these countries. We'd literally just be asking them to enforce their own border. And if they enforce their own border, one after the next, then it becomes harder and harder and harder to get anywhere near the U.S. border. And then, of course, we enforce our own border, and you get sent right back to where you came from. Like, it's defense in depth on a geopolitical scale. Like, that's something we could be working on. That's a problem we could actually solve through diplomacy, if we wanted to. If we had some common sense. And it's win-win cooperation. And all we had to do is talk with the countries that actually matter to the United States. Not faraway, bumfuck Israel. Not Syria or Egypt. Like, why was he in Egypt? Just a serious question. Why Egypt, of all places? And I'm not shitting on Egypt. I'm just saying, why Egypt specifically? What exactly are you even doing? What are you doing there? What's the end goal of going to Egypt? Like, I'm genuinely kerfuffled by that one. Like, to an extent, I can understand Israel, all right? I can understand Saudi Arabia. Okay. You want to go to Lebanon? You want to go to Lebanon? Okay. But Egypt? What are you doing in Egypt? Leave the Egyptians alone. They don't want you there anyway. But seriously, those countries are not the countries that matter to us. And it's not Europe. It's not China. And it's not the Indo-Pacific region. It's not Australia. It's our neighbors. We could solve problems by just talking to our neighbors. Why haven't we normalized relations with Cuba yet? I'm waiting. I'm still waiting. But no. We can't have that because it makes too much sense. Talking with our neighbors to solve regional problems in our own region, that makes too much sense. No. Instead, we are talking about Egypt. We're talking about Israel and Palestine. We're talking about Syria. We're talking about Ukraine, and soon enough we'll be talking about Taiwan, because it's more important for us to solve regional issues in other people's regions than in our own. That's where we're at as a country. But like I said, all these places that just don't matter to us. We are so distracted as a country. It's annoying, but I'll be honest with you, it is a little amusing too, so I can't be too annoyed at it, but it is genuinely a confusing thing to observe. Like, the solution is right there, and we're gonna swim around it even though there's no water. Like, okay, this is where we're at, huh? Like, my goodness. But all these places we don't need to be in. We could be solving problems by talking to our neighbors, but we don't do it. And so instead, we focus on things overseas, like how Poland might end up occupying Western Ukraine. Now, how could I possibly say something so radical and crazy as that? Well, my friends, my lovely listeners, Poland has been trying to mobilize a force of around 300,000 troops. The defense minister / deputy prime minister, Marius Blaczak, I believe it's how you pronounce his name, but Blaczak has been trying to get Poland's army up to 300,000 troops. And he's said a number of interesting statements. He said, quote, "We know who poses a threat to Poland and where it comes from. In fact, we've been saying it for years. For Poland, the basic threat comes from Russia and its imperial ambitions," end quote. And he said that Poland was forming a new army division on the eastern border. He also said, quote, "We need new units and new military structures. My aim is to build an army of at least 300,000 soldiers," end quote. Now, for perspective, the Polish military as of now is 150,000 strong, with like 36,000 reservists. And as we're finding out, with the war in Ukraine, they would have been obliterated. They wouldn't have an army by now. If they had fought this war instead of the Ukrainians, Poland would have already lost. And it would have been bad, it would have been quick. The war would have been over in the summer. Which gives you an idea, because Poland is one of the only countries in NATO that still has a military worthy of the name. A military. So, again, Ukraine is showing us what a conflict between NATO and Russia would have been like. And it doesn't go well for NATO. But he's seeking to actively double the force of of Poland's military, going from 150,000 to 300,000 as a minimum. He likely wants more, but he wants 300,000 as a minimum, which would give you an effective fighting force in the modern age. We thought that number was a lot smaller, or at least the Europeans did. Oh, but how wrong they were. You need at least 300,000 to even do anything, to have a meaningful force on the battlefield, especially if your stated aim is the destruction of Russia. You're going to need a few hundred thousand men to show down with Russia. 150,000 isn't going to cut it. 100,000 isn't going to cut it. 160,000 in the entirety of the British armed forces isn't going to cut it. These tiny army sizes in Europe, they're just not going to cut it. And at the very least, Poland has started to recognize that. Now, how successful they will be in training and arming all 300,000 of their troops, which really means training and arming the additional 150,000 troops, we will see. We will have to wait and see on that. But 300,000 is their goal. Now, with all this in mind, there has been talk of NATO preparing to send boots on the ground into Ukraine. So when we start thinking about why Poland would want 300,000 troops now, all of a sudden, Ukraine hasn't lost the war. I mean, if we're to believe the news, if we're to believe all these governments telling us that Ukraine's winning the war, then what reason would Poland have to try to double the size of their army? Something to think about. But why would Poland want this? And one of the potential reasons could be that NATO wants a direct intervention in Ukraine. Not just giving weapons and money and equipment to the Ukrainians, but actual boots on the ground. Now, we have one rumor saying that we're going to fight Russia directly when we do that, and we're going to support the Ukrainians. And then there's another rumor saying that we're going to use the weapons that we're giving the Ukrainians, that they themselves can't use. They can't use the air defense systems. They can't use the tanks. They can't use all of the artillery. And they can't use all of them because they haven't been trained to use all of them. And we covered that logistical aspect back in the last episode. We talked about how all the different kinds of equipment is hindering Ukraine's war effort. We talked about that, and for more on that, you can watch last week's episode. But considering that they can't use those weapons, but it's coming from NATO countries who do know how to use those weapons, there's speculation that we're giving these weapons to Ukraine specifically so that they will sit in warehouses for us to use when we go in directly to occupy part of Ukraine to keep it from falling into Russian hands. And at that point, you're fighting the Ukrainians instead of the Russians. Now there's a conspiracy for you. But it's not like they're going to do that to make peace. They're going to do that so they can preserve a part of Ukraine to continue the fight. To continue waging guerrilla operations and partisan operations from a staging ground, if you will, for further attacks on Russia to destabilize Russia, and even to a more limited extent to Belarus. It's just one escalation after the next, as we creep closer towards a shooting war with Russia. And as the war has gone on, we've even seen the mask start slipping off of these former heads of state. And we're finding out just how little Western leaders actually wanted peace with Russia. We saw Germany and France deliberately holding up on their end of the Minsk Accord so that they could buy time for Ukraine to arm and be trained by NATO specifically to fight Russia. That was the goal. Never peace. Peace was not the goal, it was war with Russia. As we're seeing now, this the destruction of Russia come up as the primary objective of these people. They want to decolonize Russia. They want to break it up. They want to Balkanize Russia. You name it. Destroying Russia is the stated aim. Which means that if Russia wants to survive as a nation, then they have to not just fight, but they have to win, and they have to win big. And I think that they will win big. Bigger than even I expected them to win as we reach this inflection point. Well, truthfully, we've passed the inflection point. The inflection point was like sometime in December, in my personal opinion. But as we've gone past this inflection point where Russia's strength now just rises and rises and rises, and Ukraine's strength has dwindled down to the point where as early as next month, they could start having issues manning their front line. Certainly by the end of March, they will. And then by the end of April. And then there's the end of May. And then there's going to be June. Because if there's no negotiated settlement, because the settlements were sabotaged right at the beginning by America and Britain, there's not going to be a negotiated settlement. Zelensky can't accept that he's losing. So there definitely isn't going to be a negotiated settlement. He doesn't know if Putin's alive or not. So there's going to be no negotiated settlement. And the Ukrainians are just being slaughtered en masse by Russian artillery fire. The weaker Ukraine's lines get, the easier it becomes for Russia to inflict those 8-to-1 casualties that they've been doing this entire war. Those casualties that Russia was inflicting when the Ukrainians had an advantage in numbers of 2-to-1 over the Russians. Now the Russians have a larger force in Ukraine than the entire combat capable section of the Ukrainian army. And they have hundreds of thousands just waiting to join the battle. 100,000 in Belarus, 100,000 in the Donbass and in southern Ukraine just not having been deployed to the front line, and another 100,000 somewhere on the Russian side of the border near Kharkov, with another 500,000 on the way, and 80 to 90,000 volunteers that were a part of that first partial mobilization. As we pass that inflection point and start to see the results of that inflection point, Russia looks like it's going to win bigger than I myself thought that they would. And as it stands, I'm still like the only person who thought that Russia was going to take all of Ukraine. Everyone else thought it was going to be a negotiated settlement. Everyone else thought it was going to be only half of Ukraine, and they were going to leave a rump state Ukraine. The only person saying that all of Ukraine was going to get annexed has been me. It's just been me. And as things have developed in the way that they have, I just get vindicated in a way that I personally wasn't expecting. And it's crazy to watch. I mean, but what Russia, they have to win big. They have to. They don't have a choice. If they want to survive as a nation, they have to win big. And I think they're going to go for that. Now, Russia's also been expelling diplomats, specifically from the Baltic countries, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. And I think that those countries, they'd be wise to interpret that as a threat to them specifically. Now, we talked last episode about how Ukraine is giving us an idea of how a war between Russia and NATO would go, and it wouldn't go well for us. So combine NATO inching towards war with Russia, their stated aim being to destroy Russia, Ukraine showing us that NATO wouldn't do well in a war with Russia, and now Russia sending veiled threats to the Baltic diplomats, and we can piece together that should Russia end up at war with NATO, they will take the Baltic states. Then they'll have a land bridge to Kaliningrad, and from there Europe can pound sand. Because it'll be over. That's it. That's all. The show's over. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Should Russia end up at war with NATO in a hot shooting war, those three countries will be annexed if NATO continues to go down this path. If we keep supplying dozens and dozens of weapons systems to Ukraine with greater and greater range and firepower, we're talking about, we just talked about tanks, they're sending tanks now that we're talking about fighter jets and long-range missiles. Before the tanks, we were talking about air defense systems. We keep talking about more and more and more, and eventually, at some point, Russia has to respond. And if all those weapons are going through NATO member states, primarily Poland, if all those weapons are going through NATO member states to reach Ukraine, where they can then be used against Russia and against the Russian people, because the Russian people are also a target of these insane warmongers who want to destroy Russia. That was the purpose of the sanctions war. It was to make life so unlivable for regular Russian people that they would rise up and overthrow Putin in this glorious revolution against him and his tyranny, so that we could then walk in and take control of Russia and exploit them for their resources. That was the idea. That was their fantasy delusion. Or more likely a delusional fantasy. But that was the stated aim. The Russian civilians, the Russian people, are a target of these people. So, if the weapons were given to Ukraine, which the Ukrainians are then being used as a vassal to attack Russia and the Russian people, if all those weapons are going through NATO to get to Ukraine, eventually, Russia has to retaliate. And they're going to have to retaliate against those NATO member states where those weapons are moving through. Like, we keep doing this. We keep escalating with Russia. And we're not involved in the war. We're not officially involved in the war. We're not a party of the war. We're at peace with Russia. But we can use this as an opportunity to destroy Russia. Well, you're not really at peace with us, are you? Like, at a certain point, Russia, they have to retaliate. They'd be retarded not to. And that's the danger. The danger that this does turn into a full-scale war between Russia and NATO. Of course, this will happen after Russia's dealt with Ukraine. And it'll happen after Russia has finished mobilizing that extra 500,000 men. On top of the 400,000 men that they mobilized before. And I say 400,000 because when they called up the 300,000, back in October, there was an additional 80 or 90,000 that volunteered to be a part of that mobilization. Then Russia decided that they needed to remilitarize in general, and then called up another 500,000 men. So you're talking almost a million, between those two mobilizations, you're talking 900,000 men on top of the Russian armed forces, which was already like 750,000 before the war started. That's 100. That's 1.6 million men. That's a massive force. More than enough to deal with a depleted, emptied out, hollowed out, has been NATO. And if there is a war between Russia and NATO, the Baltic states will be annexed and they will cease to exist as nation states as well. It won't just be Ukraine. And that's a possibility that nobody was talking about. I wasn't talking about the Baltic states getting annexed. I thought that that was just something that would happen later on. Now, granted, my analysis of the situation was flawed back when I said that, because I was still under the impression that the rebels in Ukraine were spawned by Russia, and that they're Russian separatists spawned by Russia. The separatism was instigated by Russia. Russia then comes in, funds them, backs them, and then, oh, would you look at that? Now Russia gets to take the entire country of Ukraine. I thought they would just do something similar in the Baltic states, because that's how I viewed things back then. Now, viewing things as they are now, when it's not Russia who was responsible for the breakaway republics breaking away, it was the United States, because we overthrew their government. And they said, you know what, we don't want those Nazis running us. And then we let the Nazis bomb and shell them for 8 years, pretending to care about the Minsk agreements. That's why I call these people evil. That's why I call these people evil. Because they pretended to care about this. They pretended to want peace. They played these games with other people's lives. And you know me, I don't care for being involved in all these other places around the world. But golly, that doesn't mean be an ass about it. If you don't care about someone, leave them alone. Don't lead them on to think that you're an honest, a good faith, honest negotiator just trying to find the best solution towards peace when your objective is war. When your objective isn't really just war. Like, let's be perfectly honest. It's not even just that these people want war with Russia. They want to destroy Russia. And they were willing to use the lives of Ukrainians as a means to that end. And that's evil. So that's why I call them evil. But given what I know now, it was unlikely that Russia would take the Baltic states in anything other than a conflict with NATO. But now here we have NATO committing extra hard into the war with Ukraine and escalating to the point where we could actually have that hot war with NATO. And back then, I didn't think Russia was capable of fighting all of NATO at the same time. Like, I thought that they could take the Baltics and then fight NATO to a standstill. But when we see how bad NATO is doing, what terrible condition this alliance is in, courtesy of the mass deindustrialization of the West, Russia could very easily, I say easily, but they are very likely to win a war with all of NATO at the same time. All of NATO together can't handle Russia. Russia can outproduce us in artillery and tanks and in artillery shells and in missiles. They have hypersonics and we don't. They have thermal barracks and we don't. Like, and they're doing all this with a military budget of $60 billion. $750 billion can't get us with, they can't get us what the Russians are able to get with $60 billion. So you add another $10 billion onto that, and the Russians could very well be outproducing us in aircraft production on top of that. Now that'd just be toxic. At that point, it's just toxic. But it's a possibility, because they have industry, and we don't. I never expected that this would be the case. seeing the results of deindustrialization in real time on the battlefield is something special, I'll say that much. But being vindicated in the way that I have with regards to my predictions on how Russia would, you know, gain dominance over its immediate surroundings ever since the Nagorno-Karabakh war between Armenia and Azerbaijan, I'm surprised at how accurate my order of operations have been. When the war ended and Russia was the one intervening to put the war to an end, I said Russia, I called Russia the winner of the Armenia-Azerbaijan war, because they were. They had the Caucasus on lockdown. They already fought the war with Georgia, so then with Armenia and Azerbaijan having Russians guard their borders and the entryways in and out of their country, that means the Caucasus are on lockdown. Russia had the Caucasus on lockdown. Now, Georgia likes to think it can rebel, but it can't. Not if it wants to live. And I said that they'll go for Central Asia first. They're going to secure their flank, and then they'll be able to put all their attention into Europe. And when they put their attention into Europe, it's going to be Ukraine and then the Baltics, because the Baltics are a part of NATO, which would make them the hardest part of former Russian territory to re-assimilate into Russia. And then what do we see? We saw with the Taliban's summer offensive throughout Afghanistan, we saw Russia putting its troops on other people's border with Afghanistan. They negotiated the positioning of their troops on Uzbekistan's border with Afghanistan, on Tajikistan's border with Afghanistan, and although it was unconfirmed, I believe they got a similar deal with Turkmenistan to put Russian troops on Turkmenistan's border with Afghanistan, which gave Russia an effective front line that basically mirrored the Soviet border in Central Asia. Central Asia was guarded by Russian troops, all of it. All five of those Central Asian republics. Because with Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan being guarded by Russia, and the other three, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan, already being a part of the CSTO, that meant that Central Asia was effectively on lockdown, and that lockdown was solidified when you had that attempted overthrow of the government of Kazakhstan. The Russians, as well as the rest of the CSTO, but Russia was the big boy in that operation, they intervene and put that color revolution down in 48 hours. Central Asia was on lockdown. And then I said, now they can focus all their attention on Ukraine. And then it'll be the Baltics. And here we are, with both of those effectively looking like they might end up being rolled into one another. As the war in Ukraine intensifies, Russia's directly intervened in the war in a way that they chose not to do for 8 years because they were the only ones living up to the Minsk agreements. Now those agreements are dead, and all bets are coming off of the table as we speak, and Russia is looking like it's about to gain the most complete victory, or at least one of the most complete victories in their history. On a scale that people who doubt Russia can't comprehend. A complete victory on a scale that even those of us who believe Russia is going to win the war could not have possibly comprehended or even speculated on before the war. And I'm the guy who said they're going to reintegrate all these territories, one after the next, and that they would be successful in doing so. That was me. That was my geopolitical analysis way back in the day. And by back in the day, I mean just a year and a half ago. And here we are. Ukraine will fall. And if NATO is not careful, the Baltics will be next. Now that would be something. That would be something. If at the end of this you have effectively a reunification of the Soviet borders, in Europe anyway, and a de facto control over Central Asia and the Caucasus, which will probably lead to a gradual integration into Russia via their Eurasian Federation. But the Greater Russian Federation will be born, It's just a matter of whether it's just going to be Ukraine and Belarus added to Russia, or if it's going to be Ukraine, Belarus, and the Baltics added to Russia. That's looking like it's the question, and it doesn't have to go that way. But if NATO continues down this path, where they continue to antagonize Russia, we continue to escalate against Russia, and we continue to deploy more weapons with more firepower and more range into Ukraine against Russia, eventually Russia has to retaliate. And that might lead to a hot war between NATO and Russia that NATO will not win. We won't win. We don't have the production. We don't have the military. We don't have the arsenal anymore. Because we don't have the production, we don't have the arsenal anymore. We gave it all to Ukraine and found out that modern war runs through ammunition a hell of a lot faster than bombing bandits in a desert armed with nothing more than a Quran and a Kalashnikov. Who would have thought? But the Greater Russian Federation is right around the corner. So, will the Baltics be a part of it? Or will they stay safe and independent? We'll have to find out. But that, my lovely listeners, is all I have for you today. Ooh, we've gone through a good bit, I must say. But I do hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast on my geopolitical podcast. The world is changing. The multipolar world is rising. And we are going to have fun watching it together. Now, I've been your host, Hyshawn Wade, and you've been listening to This Week in Geopolitics. So till we meet again next Monday, Servus.